Our next case is Bilotti versus Florida Department of Corrections. And we'll give just a moment for counsel to be able to get situated at the tables. All right, we'll hear first from Mr. McLean.
Good morning, Your Honors. Matthew McLean on behalf of the appellant, Kristen Bilotti. This is a 2254 proceeding in which this court certified two issues for appeal. I'd like to go ahead and start with the first issue certified for appeal, and that is whether in denying Bilotti's claim that trial counsel failed to properly preserve an issue for appeal related to the state's allegedly improper use of peremptory strike to remove a potential juror from the veneer, the state court reasonably applied Strickland versus Washington and concluding that she could not establish prejudice. We believe the answer is yes, they did unreasonably apply Strickland versus Washington. Most recently, in Judge Luck's decision in Guardado, Judge Luck went ahead and determined that in Caritelli, which is a standard used to deny Bilotti's claim, which is the defendant would have to show the actual bias of a juror on the panel, was unreasonable application of Strickland versus Washington.
Can I ask you a quick question? And this is an issue that has come up for me and now a couple of cases where I've just kind of wondered about it. I think you might be right about prejudice, Guardado and Caritelli and Davis and prejudice, all of it. But the district court also found that there was no deficient performance. That's not within the COA, but does the ordinary rule that we can affirm on any ground supported in the record somehow not apply here?
I think that we're certainly limited to the certified question, and we provided case law on that, that when a court certifies a question, you're limited in scope to what's asked of the court.
I mean, I guess I understand that you're certainly limited to the issues that you can sort of proactively put before us, but is he limited in the issues that he can urge upon us as a basis for affirmance? I mean, you know, sort of in ordinary litigation, that's always the case, right? The appellant sort of frames his or her appeal the way he or she wants to, but then the appellee can come forward with whatever old thing they want to for a basis, as a basis for affirmance. Why wouldn't that same rule apply in the COA context? It seems like once the COA is issued, now we just have an appeal.
I think it's different based off of who's crafting the issue. So whereas you stated that in crafting an issue on appeal, the appellate's counsel will craft the issue. But when the court directs a specific issue to be briefed and addressed, I think we're in a different context.
So what would happen if we don't indulge the affirm on any ground supported in the record rule here? What happens? Like, we give you your win on Guardado, goes back to the district court, and the district court says, I don't understand. Like, I already decided this issue on performance. You lose.
And fair enough. And, you know, we're comfortable enough to go ahead and say that defense counsel was deficient in this case. So even if the court feels like it can address it, we believe that we'd be successful on that part.
But isn't that another way of saying, in fact, we have to answer the deficiency question? Is there any way for us to dodge the deficiency question, even assuming arguendo? You're right on prejudice, and speaking for myself, I think you are.
I think Judge Newsom's correct that if it is remanded back to the district court, be in the same position where you'd then be arguing deficient performance, which the district court has already ruled on. So in addressing deficient performance, which I can do and which has been briefed based off of the appellee's answer brief, we did establish deficient performance in this case.
Right, but the thrust of my question to get to what Judge Newsom was asking, under the circumstances of this case with a Strickland claim, which has two prongs that must be met for you to ultimately prevail, even assuming arguendo, you're right on the first prong, don't we have to answer the second prong before we can give you the relief you want?
Yes. I agree with that.
Doesn't that mean we've got to be able to go to that question here, notwithstanding the fact that the COA was limited to half of Strickland?
I think we have to get there.
Okay, so why don't you get there for us?
So deficient performance, in this case, there was a juror on the veneer panel, and she was Black and a Jehovah Witness. During jury selection, the state went ahead and exercised a peremptory challenge on this juror, and the defense counsel raised a race-neutral reason. The response was, she's a Jehovah Witness. there's a comment by defense counsel, well, that's a religious strike-based strike, but there was never a contemporaneous objection based on it being improper strike based off religion. And so when you look at the problem,
though, that I see is there's no question that in hindsight, that's the problem. But at that point in time, there was no case, you know, the cases hadn't clearly or definitively held that challenging a juror for religious purposes was a violation of Batson. And so the problem that we come up against is twofold. One is the Strickland standard, which of course requires us to defer unless no reasonably competent attorney would have done what this attorney did. And the second one is the deference standard under AEDPA, deferring to the state court's findings. And so, first of all, maybe you can tell me why, given the state of the law at that time, no reasonable attorney would have failed to object and preserve the error.
Well, I'll start with the deference first. The state court never ruled on deficient performance. So no deference is owed to the state court. What we have here is a order strictly based off of the second prong of Strickland on prejudice. So there's no problem with owing any sort of deference, and this court should review the claim de novo if it finds it to be an unreasonable application of the prejudice prong. Regarding whether there was clear law at the time that a religious-based challenge should have been preserved, two responses to that. First, the defense counsel intended to raise the objection. The dispute that we have is, did the attorney, knowing that he wanted to preserve the objection, fail to do so under the established law, which in Florida requires a specific objection and a renewed objection. And what defense counsel failed to do was that initial objection, there was no objection based off what he wanted to do at that point in time was the religious-based objection. The second point I'd like to make is that there was case law at the time of this trial in 2015 in the state of Florida that supported objecting to a religious-based strike. If you read the Paciana decision from the 4th DCA, they cited two cases, and that's Joseph, which went ahead and was a 3rd DCA case, and they found it improper religious-based strike off of a Jewish veneer person. Then we also have Obliceris, which is also cited in the 4th DCA decision, and that one similarly found, which the 4th DCA, which is the same DCA that Ms. Blatty's case arose out of, also found that striking a Muslim veneer person for the religion was an improper basis. So at the time this trial happened, not only was the defense counsel intending to raise a religious-based objection, but there was case law there to support it. So we don't believe that this is some novel issue within the state of Florida, which defense counsel would not be aware of. Certainly this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have maybe not reached so far, but at the time Ms. Blatty's case in Florida, they had already done so.
How do we know, though, that counsel was intending to object on the basis and preserve on the basis of a religious-based strike? Yes, when he first says this, that's a religious-based strike, but when he makes his argument, he doesn't mention religion at all. So how can we, from the record, discern that he intended to do so and he, for whatever reason, just did not do so?
I think the best answer is 5 days after this juror was excused, he filed a motion for a new trial, which is his re-objection, noting that a religion-based strike was used and was improper. So we have his intent based off of this untimely filing that he did. But even if the court doesn't think that's enough, we've been deprived the right of an evidentiary hearing in this case from the onset. The initial order by the post-conviction court was a complete adoption of the state's response to one-page order, denying the claims without an evidentiary hearing. At the district court level, we also asked for an evidentiary hearing. The district court denied us the opportunity. So if this court feels that there needs to be a further development on whether defense counsel's intent was to preserve that issue, then we'd ask for the court to remand for an evidentiary hearing for the district court.
I want to come back to the question Judge Rosenbaum asked. Is it your view that Florida law had clearly established law at the time that Batson extended to a religious-based exclusion based on your reference to Joseph v. State in the other case?
Yes, I do believe that. Both of those cases...
So your view is the law was settled?
Correct. Within her very district, the law was settled on a religious-based strike. And that in Joseph, it was a Jewish veneer person, and Oblisterus was a Muslim. And the courts used specific language of it was an improper religious-based strike. So in Florida, that was established law. I see my time is up. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. All right, we'll hear next from Mr. Patty.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Senior Assistant Attorney General Paul Patty on behalf of the Secretary. Jumping right in, I know you mentioned about the extent of the COA. My interpretation is that you're not limited by simply the COA. That's a jurisdictional question, kind of an entry to the barrier. That's obviously what our limitation is on the briefing. I think you're correct, Judge Newsom. But that doesn't preclude this court from broaching the subject elsewhere.
Well, and it's funny, it didn't even really stop anybody in the briefing, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you guys briefed deficient performance to the hilt.
We sure did. And we briefed it, not briefing, but responded on deficiency below. And the report found that the deficiency assertion in the petition was conclusory. Not until appeal was it ever sussed out that the deficiency argument is really kind of dovetailing into Davis. And Davis really doesn't help Bilotti here because the distinction is very different. We're touching upon Judge Rosenbaum's point that the law was unsettled as to how to bring this about. Davis concerned settled Florida law as to the procedural aspect of how you raise a challenge and then renew a challenge. So a joiner objection. That's what's required under Florida law. But that's not what happened here. What happened here was the procedure was filed, but the underlying basis for which you were, Bilotti and Paciana were making a Batson challenge was different. Race-based reason versus religious-based reason. And I think it is highly, highly speculative that counsel was intending to raise a religious-based challenge when they said race-based challenge, because there's aspects of Florida law that I believe Judge Levine pointed out in the original Paciana 4th DCA opinion where you can use the religious basis as a piercing of the genuineness of the race-neutral reason. And I think that was the point they were trying to make. Now, it makes sense for counsel below to raise it as a race-based strike because that's clearly Batson. That would obviously be preserved. So that is a reasonable route for counsel to have driven to get to the fourth DCA and then reverse. It just so happens that in hindsight, that happened to be wrong. But it wasn't an unreasonable conclusion or the ability to move forward on that basis.
What about Mr. McLean's argument that the law was clearly established, at least for purposes of the district court, of the district in which the case took place at the time that this whole thing happened?
From what I recall, that the fourth DCA wasn't really a Batson challenge; it was a religious test challenge. So I think they're at least distinguishable. I understand where Judge Levine was going, that this is our case law and this is why this should be challenged here. But obviously the Florida Supreme Court didn't agree with Judge Levine and that this is supposed to be raised as a Batson issue. And it's supposed to follow our Batson procedure, Melbourne, that we use, the shifting of how you deal with that strike. That's how that played out.
So where do we look to discern whether the law is clearly established in Florida that you can make a Batson claim based on religion?
Well, the Florida Supreme Court would be the one.
So we couldn't look to the DCA to answer the question, could we?
No, especially since...
So even if the DCA had clearly said a Batson challenge shall lie for purposes of religious strikes of jurors, that still wouldn't clearly establish the law in Florida. Is that how you see it?
That would not make it settled Florida law, no. Okay. But I mean, I hesitate to speak in hypotheticals, but obviously there could be a certain interpretation where defense counsel could raise it if it's just in the DCA level, whereas like you kind of like try to join.
I'm talking about for our purposes.
Oh, no. Yeah. What you have to look at, what was the settled Florida law at the time? Not when there's like competing ideas of what it, like the third DCA says, what the fourth DCA says. The settled law is created by Florida.
Right. So if the DCA had said with clarity, a religious strike can be challenged under Batson.
I don't believe
not that. Enough for our purposes.
Correct.
It has to be established by the Supreme Court.
I would believe that's the correct interpretation, Your Honor.
What about Joseph v. State? Let's hold aside who has to establish the law. Was it established by any DCA anywhere?
Not under
at the relevant time frame.
Not under Batson. Not that I recall from Joseph.
Right? That is to say, Batson has been extended to right, include correct. Religious strikes.
Correct. As to Florida DCA extending under the state level, Batson to religious-based strikes, I don't think those cases stand for that proposition. They talk about religious tests.
Which, what does Joseph v. State stand for? Do you see it?
From what I remember, I believe it's just the it's a violation of the religious test to prevent a juror based solely on their religion. I think in Joseph it was they were Jewish, and then in the fourth, I forget the name of the case, but the alternative case in the fourth was a Muslim case.
Right.
But I think they were traveling under a different, I think it was just an equal.
So if I understand your argument on this issue, it's clear, holding prejudice aside, there was no clearly established law, QED, they couldn't have been incompetent or fell beneath some expected standard of counsel here for not raising it.
Correct. Yeah. And I believe it would, I think it's still, you have to kind of look at the Guardado as to where the deficiency even lay, because this is a post-conviction. This is not the appellate, because we're still kind of traveling under this idea that Davis controls here. Florida has rejected the Davis test. So while we didn't rule on deficiency below, I think when you talk about deficiency, you kind of have to keep deference for the Florida courts because we don't recognize the Davis test. Does that make sense? You apply Guardado is that the test that we utilize, we say Davis is wrong, that it's not about whether it's a prejudice on appeal and the deficiency to fail to preserve. That's not the test. The test in post-conviction land for Florida is whether a juror was biased. Now, correct, Guardado speaks to the idea that our actual bias in fact test is wrong, but that's the test you still need to apply. So the deficiency there would be failing to show that, you have to show that a juror is a reasonable probability that they are not impartial, because that's the basis of the Sixth Amendment right.
Well, I'm sorry. Why would you have to show that what the law was at the time when we're not talking about deficiency? We're talking about prejudice.
No, what I'm saying is that Bellotti wants to travel under Davis to show deficiency. Now, we at Florida did not address deficiency below, and that's why the report addresses deficiency de novo. What I'm saying is that Guardado doesn't change the analysis for Florida as to the appropriate test. Davis still doesn't apply, because Davis has to do with whether the failure to preserve the claim. I'm saying that that's not the appropriate test in post-conviction, because we don't recognize the Davis test. We recognize the juror bias test. Does that answer your question? I wanted to make this clear.
That's fine.
Okay. So, and just to kind of wrap that up, it's Davis is not recognized under Florida law because it's not clearly established federal law. We recognize the juror bias test, and Guardado accepts that as an acceptable test under Strickland. But
I'm sorry. I do want to get back to that.
Sure.
So I understand the Davis test to be a prejudice test. You're saying it's not a prejudice test?
No, it is a prejudice test. I'm saying that the deficiency holding, because they had to find both prongs in Davis. And they're saying that the failure to preserve was the deficiency. And the prejudice prong was that it affected the appeal. Does that make it
yes.
all clear?
Yes, okay. That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
Why is that wrong?
Because we don't recognize that as the appropriate test. That's what Caritelli kind of stands for. We're saying that we looked at Davis because the 11th Circuit.
For prejudice purposes.
You right. Know. Yeah, I'm just saying that the deficiency prong is also different. That there's a biased juror that had to be removed. That the deficiency was this counsel didn't remove this juror. So they show a biased juror, and then the deficiency is that the counsel didn't attempt to remove them. I feel like I'm confusing you. And that's not my intention.
Why don't you go on to your next point?
As to prejudice, the secretary wouldn't object to the application of Gordeta. It was just clear. Presuming you can pierce the veil of deference. I'll just make that clear. Gordeta can be the appropriate test if you go through the deference that's owed to the state. Seeing as that's all was discussed in the beginning, if there's any more questions, I would rest on my brief and then ask to affirm.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll hear again from Mr. McLean. You've reserved 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to start off with the way Florida case law works. So if the Florida Supreme Court has a decision, then that binds all the district court and trial courts. If there's no Florida Supreme Court case law, then binds trial courts is what the District Court of Appeal decides, especially when it's from their own DCA. So if there's DCA opinions that are on point on this issue, that's what defense counsel would know at the time would apply to the case. And so when we look at what was actually held in Joseph, I'll read from Paciano, the third district following the same line of cases held that a peremptory challenge of a Jewish veneer person based solely upon the religion was unconstitutional. The court found that members of the Jewish religion were a cognizable class under the standard articulated in Allen. The Joseph court determined that members of the Jewish faith met the two-prong test and concluded that striking members of the Jewish faith violated Article 1, Section 16 of the Florida Constitution, which guarantees the defendant an impartial jury. Later on Paciano, they talk about the obliterous decision.
But I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm looking at Joseph right now, and it says, we are careful to point out that our decision is grounded upon principles of state constitutional law. Having concluded that the Florida Constitution prohibits the kind of discrimination involved in this case, we do not analyze this issue under the federal constitution or case law. Why isn't that a problem?
It's not a problem, because what we're looking at is what defense counsel should have done in the circumstances. So if the defense counsel knows that striking a juror based off religion violates the Florida Constitution, then to be effective, they need to object and preserve the argument for appeal based off of the Joseph decision and the Blister's decision.
But the problem is, right, but the problem, all right, I think I see what you're saying. You're saying that it still violates the Sixth Amendment, right, regardless of whether it's under state or federal law.
Correct. So we're applying under Strickland, you know, is there in 2254, is there some unreasonable application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent? And that's Strickland. But when we are analyzing defense counsel's performance, we're judging them based off what the case law for the state and for the applicable to the case is. So based off Joseph, they would have known that that was an improper strike under the Florida Constitution, and they would have known to preserve an issue for appeal. You have to go ahead and make a contemporaneous objection, and then you have to renew that objection. So we believe that deficient performance is absolutely established in this case. And when you look at what happened below, the post-conviction court didn't address deficient performance at all, nor did the state in their response. So in a way, we've been operating under this situation where ineffective assistance has deficient performance has been presumed essentially throughout this entirety of the proceeding. And that's because the Florida Supreme Court said he messed up. He didn't preserve the issue that he wanted to preserve. And based off of that, she lost her right to the jury, a fair jury, and based off of her right to get a new trial in the case. The last point that I'd like to go ahead and talk about is the prejudice in this case. And so when we're looking at prejudice, normally this court would defer to the state court in their prejudice finding. But once you get past that veil of that application of clearly established Supreme Court precedent, then you get the de novo standard. And that applies to both deficient performance and prejudice. So based off of us getting the more favorable review, this court would be sitting in a position where it is judging this case based off the Davis decision, which is binding on this panel. And as the district judge below ruled, had it been the first court to be reviewing this claim for prejudice, it would have found prejudice because David binds it to do so. And we established a reasonable probability that her appeal would have been successful. So we're asking the court to grant habeas relief to Ms. Blotti. We're asking her to be afforded a new trial in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.